In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
The next question and answer, also due to compliments of Reddit, I suppose, is trends synergy with HGH. And one of the things that I thought was funny is they threw in an edit. This is like reporting back from the field. This is probably a chief science officer at some academic institution, right? We're back with another question and answer series. So David Day Mosqueda and I are going to react to advice on, Reddit? Yeah, Reddit, one of the best places where you should get all of your advice regarding fitness.
Yeah, especially our steroids.
What's up with the hate for Klin? First of all, do you hate Klin? Because as a medical doctor, I do strongly dislike Klin. Klin is clenbuterol, for those who don't know, which is like a very long-acting version of albuterol that makes your heart race, gives you the shakes.
Klin is one of the best performance-enhancing drugs ever made, especially for fat loss.
So you didn't answer the question. Do you dislike it, though?
I love it.
I guess compared to DNP, maybe it's not terrible. But this poster says a lot of people on r/steroids do not like clenbuterol. There's no side effects and only benefits. That's where I definitely know that there's side effects.
I would say that Klin, when you're in a healthy state, there are a low amount of side effects. If you're healthy and like your adrenal function is in a good spot, if you're in a bad spot, and I have experienced being in a bad spot with clenbuterol before, it is a terrible compound. In fact, I took Klin one time when my adrenals were in such a bad spot and it was the worst prep I've ever had. And it was making me go to sleep every single time. My adrenals were so shot. So there are definitely side effects when it comes to Klin. I'm very well aware of that. And not everyone can handle Klin. And there's like genetic discrepancies that come into place as well, where someone can tolerate Klin well versus not. And we can kind of jump into that.
Well, I'm glad that I will never know if I tolerate it, because I will never take it or do any steroid cycles. But occasionally I do take an albuterol inhaler because I have cold-induced bronchospasm. And very seldom, if the inhaler is not quite enough, occasionally I'll take 1 milligram that has been prescribed to me, of course, of albuterol sulfate. So when that happens, I do notice, I only take it in the morning, because if I took it in the evening, my eight sleep would say my heart rate is higher. So tachycardia and very likely tachyarrhythmias are going to be a side effect of this. So there's a reason why we don't give clenbuterol as a prescription for asthmatics.
Yeah, Klin is a terrible compound as far as going for like asthmatics. Albuterol does exactly what you need to do when you need it. It gets out of the system. Mm-hmm. And Klin, I can tell you very much so that it will increase your heart rate. You tend to get somewhat adjusted to the heart rate changes, but the fat burning properties stay deployed. And that's like really what you're trying to go for in the actual bodybuilding space, is you're using it for a fat loss compound. And that BPM changes that you see, the beat per minute, where, I mean, I've seen up to 20 beat per minute. I've seen 30 beats per minute, right?
Yeah.
And if you're not monitoring that stuff, then you shouldn't even be taking Klin to begin with, because you need to know if your body's actually in a sympathetic state versus a parasympathetic state. And if you're constantly in a fight or flight state, it's actually harder to get in shape anyways. So the Klin is not really doing what you're wanting it to do, even though it's obviously increasing how much body fat you're burning. Mm-hmm. But if you're constantly in a high stress state and you're also not sleeping, probably going to become insulin resistant and have a hard time dropping that body fat anyways.
If really, really good elite bodybuilders are almost always heavily parasympathetic, then why don't I have huge muscles? Because I am.
Oh, man. You just have to run a cycle. You just said you're never going to, though.
Yeah, I suppose you're probably never going to be an open bodybuilder if you're never pushing things too much. All the running in CrossFit is probably an opportunity cost. Now, this is actually a good conversation, not related to the Reddit post, but is running killing my gains? I mean, I am probably 13% body fat, and I weigh probably 225 to 230, but I'm pretty tall. So compared to normies out there, you know, I have big muscles, like big arms, but compared to any bodybuilder, I'm tiny. Yeah, so
sure.
I mean, so is it the running and the CrossFit that's killing my gains, or is it just because that's how I spend my time and then I'm basically not doing good enough resistance training?
I love this question because there was not a lot of science behind this, and we figured this out a long time ago, just like through observational, like whenever we get ready for spring break in college, right? Mm-hmm. We'd implement cardio, right? And we always noticed that like whenever we started doing cardio, we actually started gaining more muscle tissue every single time. Like even though we were burning body fat, we were in a slight deficit and stuff like that, we always put on more muscle tissue and our strength started to improve more. Mm-hmm. And I think that the strength improvement had to do with the cardiovascular strength yep. that came with it. So your progressive overload, which we didn't even know that principle back then, was constantly improving over that time. So your volume was increasing. So you're getting stronger, you're gaining more muscle tissue from hypertrophy. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, you also see the secondhand residual of you're actually getting leaner and you might even be becoming more insulin sensitive during that mm-hmm. period of time. So it works on a multi-cascade system. But I think the biggest one with cardio implementation is as long as you're not running a marathon daily, you're not running more than like 60 plus minutes or 2 hours, right? It's probably going to improve your overall performance. And I'd probably say the general rule of thumb that I find is up until 50 minutes or so is a sweet spot. Even within bodybuilding preps for most of my athletes, they don't go above 45 to 50, 55 minutes probably. Mm-hmm. Because I find that the performance reduces down so much after that point where the intensity doesn't even matter anymore.
Yep.
So you might as well just do like steps in a day after that point.
Yeah, that makes sense. I use a lot of arc trainer and occasionally I do stair stepper, but I do arc trainer more often because I don't love ellipticals because the unnatural pattern for the knee and the ankle. I think the arc, like the Cybex arc trainers, is much more natural. And compared to a row erg or a ski erg or even walking on a treadmill, even an incline walk, it transfers over much better to muscular endurance, which is different than strength and also different than, you know, your lactate threshold and your VO2 max. So it kind of allows me to continue to be decent at cardio. And then, like you said, I've definitely noticed that, you know, like a high rep, fairly heavy bench, at least for me, probably not for you, but like 10 reps of 225, I am not out of breath whatsoever. Whereas I've noticed a lot of people that, you know, don't do cardio, 10 reps of 225 that have the same max bench of me, maybe like 315-ish, is extremely difficult. They're huffing and puffing and they have to take a 5-minute break after something like that. So I could certainly see why cardio can make you a more efficient muscle gainer. But yeah, you're going to have to train better than me if you want to have good results. So it's probably just the lack of ideal, truly training to failure progressive overload resistance training that that's the...
I would attribute it to resistance training, lack of amount of resistance training more so than anything else, because you're training with a purpose and that's functionality more so than anything else. It's strength plus functionality. I do think there's a very nice blend. In fact, one of my clients, who's I consider family by this point, his name is Coach Blue on Instagram. He's mm-hmm. like over 8 million followers now. It's crazy. But he got famous for doing crazy stuff because he was a pro calisthenic athlete.
Oh, nice.
And he's also an amazing bodybuilder too. And he blends hypertrophy training with actual that anaerobic, even aerobic activity. And he shows that you can be functional as well as a bodybuilder. And I think it can be done well. Do I think it can be done as number one in the world? Probably not, because you don't want the muscle fibers to get too stretched out. Or if you do stretch out the muscle fibers, you need to shrink them back down and tighten them back down to get that more round bubbly look, to have as much muscle tissue as possible, which is also terrible for performance. Like bodybuilding does not translate into any sport well. It's actually the polar opposite. That's why.
That's true.
Go for a sprint right after a workout, mm-hmm. which I was dumb and I did it. And I blew up my hamstring, like literally felt the blowout, went into shock afterwards.
Yep.
And that's usually when you hear bodybuilders getting injured, is they go for a jog or a run.
They're also heavier. Yeah, I've said anyone over 200 pounds, regardless, even if it's good body comp, if you start functional fitness or high rocks or CrossFit, then you're extreme risk of injury. Partly because you're too strong for your own good, but Also, your tendons and ligaments have not adapted. Shout out to our podcast. We can probably link it between Cameron right here and my functional fitness, like trainer coach, Stormy. Basically talking about why, a lot of things, but it's a debate between bodybuilder Cameron and functional fitness trainer Stormy. And Stormy has reiterated accurately that even though bodybuilders are often extremely strong, they usually do the worst trying, not necessarily the worst, it's the most difficult transition to things like functional fitness.
And I would completely agree with it. And I'm on that track record right now. Now, I've been downsizing for 3 years. It's funny when people are like, why would you listen to this guy? He doesn't even look like he lifts. I'm way smaller than what I used to be back in the day.
That's ridiculous.
And, but I'm excited to do functional training. I have my hip surgery next week, which I'm so excited about because I can go outside and I can run again.
Yes.
I'm right around 200 pounds now. Last time I was 196 pounds, I was having a massive Graves episode and I striated glutes. I was like leaner, almost leaner than any bodybuilding show that I've ever done, just walking around. So I can say it's going to take me a little while to maintain under 200 pounds, but having less weight, I just feel better. And going for a run, I know I can do it and I'll be able to implement some functionality with bodybuilding and do a blend. And it's going to be cool seeing how I mold and shape my physique as well as how much athletic performance I can keep in there because I want to be able to do the rings and things like that just for fun.
Rings are really fun. So I think that's a good takeaway. We can wrap up this question by saying add cardio into your regimen instead of clean.
Wait, really? I want to do both.
So
it helps, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. There's no downside, you know, just like a peptide.
Yeah,
no downside. Just think about the upsides and not the downsides, and it won't happen. Not really, though. So the next question and answer, also due to, you know, compliments of Reddit, I suppose, is trends synergy with HGH. And one of the things that I thought was funny is they threw in an edit. So, you know, this is like reporting back from the field. This is probably a chief science officer at some academic institution, right? A guy in his early 20s grew 3 inches. What grew 3 inches? But anyway, he grew, presumably his height grew 3 inches after adding Tren with the HGH. What's the deal with this?
That's really interesting. So androgens obviously don't close up growth plates, whereas estrogen does. It's potentially that depending on how he ran his cycle, right? Like if test wasn't in conjunction, which would be super interesting because that used to happen back in the day, it'd be like other androgens with no testosterone, which I don't think they're saying that they're even taking testosterone here. If it was Tren and it lowered his estrogen, it would have kept growth plates slightly opened up. And then adding in the HGH will also potentially increase the amount of space for those growth plates. So they could have grown from that. I mean, I stopped growing in seventh grade, so I can't speak much to that. I just got really wide after I went to college. And when I was 19, I had a growth spurt for sure. And it had to do with IGF-1.
Also, I did not get taller. You had high DHEA. So you had a strong adrenarchy.
That would actually make sense.
So as your DHEA converts to estrogen, you're going to grow, you're going to have your growth spurt faster and your long bones are going to close up their growth plates faster. Yeah, sometimes kids with really strong adrenarches, which is, you know, you think of kids that have like a couple random hairs on the chin, even in middle school, you know, early growth, some androgenic changes, but mostly due to the adrenals making lots of DHEA rather than the gonads making hormone, both for females and males. Sometimes they could benefit from an aromatase inhibitor just to kind of stretch out that growth phase. Anyways, not truly related to trend synergy with HGH.
Right.
Any sort of growth hormone, whether it's HGH or a growth hormone peptide or an IGF-1 related peptide like IGF-1 or IGF-1-LR3 is, of course, going to have some synergy with an androgen. So sure. I think that this simple is this question is as simple as that.
I'm actually really curious in your field of work. Have when it comes to children wanting to grow taller and their parents saying, hey, let's go to the doctor, right? And
sure.
Usually traditionally it's here's some growth hormone, right? Or used to be. Do you see them leveraging growth hormone secretagogues now instead of direct growth hormone? I would assume no, because
not endocrinologists, but I have. I've actually had several children in my practice for pretty much 5 years at this point. And I have had a few that after shared decision making have chosen to utilize growth hormone releasing peptides, which some have been studied and kind of temporarily approved for growth hormone deficiency. And I have had one that did meet criteria for growth hormone deficiency, didn't have insurance coverage, chose to do just growth hormone releasing peptides and had an exceptionally good result. Yeah, much more final height and stature than was expected.
Now, adding so to
it,
that.
It can help, but I don't see conventional medicine doing that at this point.
From an IGF-1 standpoint, do you have a track record on where they started and where they ended from the secretagogues? Because like a lot of people don't mm-hmm. respond is what I find. And a lot of money gets burned a lot of times. Some people have great responses though.
The worse your pituitary function is, the less likely you're going to respond. In fact, growth hormone secretagogues are also used. This is how they are used clinically. They are used for what's called a growth hormone stimulation tests. So you check a growth hormone level, you take a growth hormone releasing peptide, sometimes IV even, but also subcutaneous or IM. And then as it peaks, you check to see if the growth hormone level increases. So that is often how they're used. But there's obviously different types of deficiency. Is it hypothalamic? Is it pituitary? If the pituitary is the issue and your growth hormone releasing hormone receptor is not as sensitive, or your area of the pituitary that produces growth hormone is just not as active, then you're not going to get an ideal response.
Sure. Also, estrogen levels matter too. So if you have increased levels of estrogen, you're usually going to get a better response to any type of growth hormone because the IGF-1 conversion is directly related to estrogen. A lot, part of it's directly estrogen related.
Yep. And estrogen will potentiate the response of most pituitary hormones. It's kind of one of the 5 or 6 keys that turns on the nuclear code to your pituitary. You got to have, well, it's your hypothalamus and your pituitary. In the hypothalamus, you have your leptin, you have your kisspeptin. You also have anything that binds the estradiol receptor. So estriol can often be used and more often in females. But you also have to have, enough, from the growth hormone standpoint, enough ghrelin agonism and enough GHRH receptor agonism. But I think that's probably a good summary of that question. The next question is, are the safest steroids test and primo, generally speaking? So this would be your TRT plus. You paid a high price to go to a guru just for them to tell you to take tests and a little primo.
Yeah. Am I supposed to answer this one first?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So tests and primo, is it the safest? I'd probably say when you're looking at a holistic view, probably yes. You tend to see that testosterone and primo, the least impactful on a negative effects on your lipid profile, just generally speaking, from what I've seen. Now, the issue with me saying that yes to primo is that I think that masterone is a better option most of the times if you're worried about estrogenic side effects like gynecomastia. The reason for that is systemic estrogen is great for us when you're overall trying to gain as much muscle tissue as possible. And mass tends to not reduce down systemic estrogen nearly as effectively as primo does. Now, if someone just aromatizes that testosterone really heavily into estrogen, primo is probably the better option. But you can also do a blended approach of primo and mast. And I find that a lot of guys psychologically feel better on masterone than primo as well because they have higher systemic levels of estrogen and it's good for neurotransmitter health.
If they're on a high test base, presumably.
Correct. If they're on a high, yep. as if test is the base, right? And yep. you do see these cycles now where they're like 200 milligrams of testosterone and I'm not even making this up, like grams of primo and grams of masterone and stuff like that.
I've seen
crazy numbers.
A lot of people will keep the test the same, 200, 250, whatever, and they'll go high, medium, low, pause off of primo or mast. Of course, from my standpoint, unless this is, a someone who had a prescription for Masterone for their breast cancer, they're probably not getting their primobolan. Right? That's what primo is primobolan or methinolone, usually in the form of methinolone enanthate as the ester. Yeah, unfortunately not a prescription option, because I do agree from what I see both in the clinical literature and anecdotally, pretty good safety profile. But of course, I always recommend against methinolone enanthate and also anything in general that is not prescribable. So the other thing that I would say is for those of, you know, people listening that just have health as a goal but want maybe a little bit more muscle than the 75 mgs once a week of testosterone and enanthate that they're getting from their endocrinologist, they're probably better off just seeing how they can tolerate it and then talking to that doctor or maybe a different doctor that understands that there can be a pretty wide therapeutic window for testosterone replacement for many people.
Yeah, testosterone is the saying that test is the best is always a bodybuilding saying. And I do stand by that. I think that men, even through FDA ranges that are legal, can get a massive amount of results by just throttling up the testosterone. Most men do not aromatize to the point where they're ever going to get gyno within FDA realm. And all that they have to do is split up their shots into daily shots if they aromatize heavier, and that will reduce down how much estrogen they're converting. That's one major option that you can do. I do like growth hormone, by the way. I wish that, and I do like Primo, and I'll talk about the reason why I actually wish that Primo is still FDA approved.
Agreed.
The reasoning behind it is I also have data on 120 milligrams of testosterone. And I was having elevated prolactin levels. And this is probably due to dopamine more than anything else. But my estrogen levels as I aged increased. And I feel great on higher estrogen. But because my prolactin was high, I was also getting those emotional side effects. Yep. And I wanted to pull it down. So I started taking a low dose of aromasin at 12.5 milligrams, which is half a pill for most people, once per week to just bring it down, at least the enzymatic process of converting it into estrogen. And it brought it down into a 36. And so it went from 66 estrogen to 36. And then my prolactin levels did come down a little bit. Now, the issue with it is my LDL skyrocketed up.
Yes.
And then on top of it, my ApoB also skyrocketed up. So I decided to drop the aromasin, let it come back up, and it went right back up to what it was previously. Yep. And then I added in 30 milligrams of Primo. So it was 120 test, 30 milligrams of Primo. And it brought my estrogen, ironically enough, right back down to a 36, which is weird.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful.
And which most people don't realize, I think they just get like fake Primo or underdose Primo and they're like, oh yeah, it's not that strong. It's
a lot of Primo has mast in it too. I know I've seen a study that showed something like more than half of primobolan pharmaceutical, because in some countries it is still pharmaceutical, just had mastrone or some other AAS in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know what I've said before, maybe not publicly, but if you had to clinically dose Primo, because people always say, oh, it needs to be 1-to-1 or it needs to be 2-to-1 Primo to test. It's like, well, yeah, maybe if you want to look like a tomato, or it needs to be a 2-to-1 test to Primo. I think something more along the lines of 10-to-1 for a more sustainable actual replacement option, especially for individuals that don't have a particularly sensitive androgen receptor. Because at the same estradiol level, there's your risk for hyperestrogenic symptoms. And gyno, of course, is not a huge health risk. It's just a physical sign that there's too much otherwise estradiol receptor agonism. And of course, males can get breast cancer if they have gynecomastia. We know. But I do think that you make a compelling argument to where there could be clinical use for low doses of primobolan, something like 10 mgs a week with 100 mgs a week of testosterone, or 15 and 150, maybe for individuals that need that higher androgen pool in order to have that benefit.
Yeah, from a psychological standpoint, I felt better. My LDL improved and my ApoB also improved again. So it's one of those things where it has a very solid used case. And again, one of the few compounds that I feel like has a good use case for being FDA approved for men.
Yep. So RFK, if you're listening, just like you hopefully listen to your debate stack, we love that you're advocating for TRT. I know that I think it was Derek or Rogan or someone asked him about his TRT protocol, which he is on, which I think is great. That's going to help it, several things. But this next question is, why is Primo typically preferred over Mastro? And we basically spoke about this, but I guess other than it is more expensive and fancy. Why is Ferrari preferred over a Corvette?
So I like Mastrone over Primo, and that's my argument. Why? I feel better on it. I feel like dose for dose, it's more effective for what I need to get out of it from an estrogen control standpoint rather than a systemic estrogen standpoint. I psychologically feel better on Mastrone. So I'd make an argument that I think Mastrone is a better compound than Primo. Now, if you're talking about open bodybuilder dosages that are absolutely insane, Primo is probably going to be a better bet because you're going to have to control that systemic estrogen anyways. And in crazy dosages, that Primo is going to have what I see more of a anabolic factor. I hate to say it like that because we know that milligram per milligram, you gain approximately the same amount of muscle tissue across the board. The argument that I have with it is I think that people push Primo too high and reduce down systemic estrogen too much because estrogen is so important for overall developing muscle tissue over time via IGF-1 levels and storing muscle skeletal muscle glycogen. So I think that people lean into Primo too heavily, and I think that a blended approach is probably better, especially with open bodybuilder dosages. It's about to be very hard to find Primo. It's about to be very hard to find Mastrone, and people are about to buy a lot of testosterone, I think.
Why is that?
The tariffs coming into place. Oh. China's shutting down basically imports into the U.S.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So FDA approved Primo.
Yeah. Next question. There's a lot of good and bad advice regarding diet for fitness, bodybuilding, and otherwise. But a lot of people are on the carnivore diet or a ketogenic diet. And this individual would just like to know more about the benefits and downfalls. So it's a good question. Yeah. So what are some of the benefits and downsides of the carnivore diet, if there's any benefits?
One thing that always infuriates me is when people say that extreme diets don't have downsides. So there's a double-edged sword to everything, unfortunately. And that's could even be like literally training too much, right? Training is great until you're training too much. The devil lies in the dose. So the thing that I don't like about the carnivore diet is the lack of fiber. That's my biggest downside, downfall with the carnivore diet is lack of fiber. And then people arguing the fact that cholesterol doesn't increase your risk of cardiovascular disease, which is not true. Now, it's a combination of glucose levels and
inflammation.
LDL. And so total inflammation, net inflammation equals disease, really. And they'll be like, yeah, I'm at a 200 or 300 LDL. It's not increasing my risk of heart disease, or I haven't seen an impact on my LDL levels yet. And then next thing you know, a year later, they come back and their cardiovascular risk is extremely high on paper. And their blood glucose levels are elevated now too, because I like carbohydrates to manage cortisol levels. So that's the major issues that I see is more along the lines of lack of fiber and then LDL levels staying elevated too high for too long. So maybe if cholesterol medicine was added into the mix, like an ezetimibe, then that would have more of a used case. But I like well-balanced diets overall anyways. But carnivore diet, the biggest issue with it is lack of fiber. The other downside is there is usually temporary release or relief with the gastrointestinal system. And then the net gain long-term, I think negatively impacts the gastrointestinal system because you get the starvation of bacteria, but yet you're eating a bunch of protein. So you're getting a growth of bacteria from the protein. And it counteracts that argument of you're starving the bacteria, maybe for a temporary amount of time. And I think you get a reduction in oxalates where you're clearing them out of your system. And it's probably miserable for the first 2 weeks, and then you get adjusted to it and you get a clear headedness from the ketones. But those are the benefits. And then I think the biggest downsides is lack of fiber.
Yeah. It's a much worse ketogenic diet. A regular ketogenic diet has all the same benefits without a bunch of the downsides. There is a couple Reddit posters that advocated for the carnivore diet. This one says it is miraculous. We mentioned the cognitive function, but what do you think about this?
Let's see what they talk about. So they talk about enhanced cognitive function, better mental health, hormone balance. I disagree with that. White teeth, better skin, disagree with that too. Improved gut health, disagree with that. I've already touched on that. Increased energy, not performance in the gym, so I'd kind of disagree with that. And then disease reversal, disagree with that, because I've seen elevated blood glucose levels in people that are on carnivore diets because of the lack of carbohydrates that help with the balance of cortisol.
There's a difference between someone that is 300 pounds and diabetic on the carnivore diet and a 120 pound skinny individual with no inflammation and no insulin resistance. So, you know, just because some people can make this work does not mean it is a good diet for everyone. And that's why you see most people that are carnivore advocates switching to just regular ketogenic diets or carnivore plus berries or whatever the latest fad is. One thing that I do think is interesting is the discussion about how carnivore diets do increase ketone bodies. And ketone bodies certainly have benefits in the gut and in the brain. But for people who want those benefits, rather than drastically change into a very restrictive diet, then why not just take exogenous ketone esters?
And that could be an argument, right? And I think that's a very good use case. If you enjoy, here's my biggest thing about dieting. If you enjoy the food that you're eating, you're going to stick to it and it's going to be a good diet for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that just being within caloric maintenance levels or maybe even slight deficit for longevity is great. And that's really what you need to lean into. If you don't enjoy the diet and you're restricting yourself long term, I just don't think that you should be doing it.
Yeah. The macro argument is also a decent argument for higher fat or ketogenic diets, especially for people producing testosterone naturally. And people will say, well, 40% of your diet needs to be fat to optimize your testosterone. But they're forgetting the difference between relative percentage and absolute. You can have two individuals. One maybe is like me, higher body weight, exercises a ton. If 40% of my diet is fat, then that is, 400, 800, 1600, probably almost 2000 calories of fat every day. I do not need 2000 calories of fat. So I think it more has to do with the absolute amount of fat. So I think about people who are on a 2000 calorie diet, and I would say if roughly 700 for females, less, probably 400 to 500 calories per day comes from fat. Just divide that by 9 to get your grams, and that's generally an optimal amount of fat for calories. So I've seen the studies on the 40% figure and the 1/3 figure, but I don't necessarily agree with that.
So my numbers that I like to run it by is almost like a 40-40-20. I like 40% protein, 40% carbs, 20% fat, and I find that a general rule of thumb where it works out pretty efficiently. Maybe you can teeter-totter that protein down to like 5% margin and then increase the carbohydrates. But again, most women, number-wise, 50 to 60 grams of fat is probably going to be a pretty healthy, sufficient number. Mm. And then carbohydrates, I just tend to see overall body composition being better on a carbohydrate-based energy source rather than a fat-based energy source over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a 200-pound female like Maddie, that is, 17% body fat on a DEXA, then you don't need 40% of your calories. She probably has 3,500 calories per day, extremely active, both in what she does on a day-to-day basis and very frequent high intensity like and steady state cardio. I don't think that, she might even be able to get by with less than 20% from fat. But and I suppose you could make the case that testosterone optimization via dietary fats probably a bit more important for males and probably a bit less important for someone with, say, PCOS.
100%. I mean, that's a whole other rabbit hole there when you're talking about glucose management and stuff like that, insulin resistance with women with PCOS. I find that actually anyone who's an athlete, you need to be focusing on overall glucose management and insulin sensitivity. If you actually care about how you're going to show up in the gym that day or to CrossFit or to that sprint, whatever you're doing for your sport.
I thought that this post did have a good point about vitamin C. If you're not eating carbs, then you're probably not eating enough vitamin C. So that's pretty actionable. Cheat days, that's tough. whether it's carnivore or keto, because a cheat day can really derail you and kind of put you through that tough first 2 week period. So there's not a lot of diet flexibility. I think one of the downsides that's not really mentioned is the social downside. Not just because you can't have that flexibility, but everyone else is probably going to be annoyed at you, whether you're vegan or you're carnivore.
Yeah, it's almost like being gluten-free, right? Now, I will say that at like a lot of restaurants and stuff like that do have gluten-free options now.
It's not near as bad.
No, not near as bad. But a diet like this, because you have to make sure that you're staying into a ketogenic state, is the biggest issue. Mm-hmm. There's actually a diet that I did a long time ago that I would actually have a feed day. So I was a ketogenic diet followed by one feed day where you'd like overload the body with carbohydrates. And I found it more effective for when you're in a ketogenic state for longer, that day when you're feeding did make a massive difference. And I would actually take metformin on those days. I'd take 1,000, I'd take 1 gram total of metformin for those bigger meals. I do 500 and 500 split. Mm. And it was actually pretty effective for like, definitely like recharging. The issue is you felt good for like 3 days and then you started feeling bad again. And every single time that I get it back into a ketogenic state, it was miserable to get back into it again.
Better stack would have probably been miglitol, allulose, and an SGLT2.
I get with that.
Yep. Pee out the glucose, inhibit alpha-glucosidase, but the miglitol, and blunt the insulin and glucose response too. Anyways, I think that's a good summary of this common pitfalls. Not terrible advice on this post.